Welcome to Across the Desk and our new series in partnership with CASDA, the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance. This series is focused on the National Autism Strategy. We hope you'll join the conversation about how this strategy can help autistic Canadians have full and equitable access to the resources they need to live a full life. The time to have this conversation is now. And welcome to Across the Desk. My name is Elizabeth Kloof, and I am the host of Across the Desk. And we're back today with our partnership podcast with CASDA. CASDA is the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance, which is serving to improve life for all autistic Canadians on a variety of fronts. And I am thrilled today to welcome Amy Lonsbury, all the way from Alberta. And she's
Woo!
Yeah, there we go.
It's radio.
Common thing that people forget that they have to say.
Right. Okay. Yeah, there
we go. So welcome, Amy. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you for the nomination. It's nice to be liked.
That's right. So
I'm going to launch into Amy's bio, and then we are going to talk about what we're going to talk about. So Amy Lonsbury is a policy and privacy officer. What does MPA stand for?
I have a master's in public administration.
Look at you, smarty pants.
I try.
There you go. Amy joined the Seneve Family Foundation in 2013 and has served as both a board secretary and director of operations. As policy and privacy officer, she focuses on social policy initiatives designed to build system capacity and supporting Seneve's corporate services. A politically astute, creative thinker who loves collaborating with a diverse group on complex problems, Amy has earned a reputation as someone that gets things done. Testify. The first 10 years of Amy's career were spent building a successful retail sales and marketing career. In 2005, she shifted her career path from the for-profit sector to the not-for-profit sector by earning a master's in public administration from the University of Victoria. After completing her MPA, Amy spent several years as an associate with a healthcare consulting practice. Amy demonstrates her deep connection to her community by volunteering. She is a Red Cross volunteer and recently completed serving as a director with the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance. In 2005, Amy was one of 8,000 Albertans awarded the Alberta Centennial Medal, which recognized those whose achievements have benefited their fellow citizens, their community, and their province. Well, aren't you a little cup of tea and a cookie on the side?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. I'll own that.
I'm patting myself on the back.
As you should. You know what? It was a proud day. I got a community service medal for my work in Girl Guides of Canada as a Girl Guide leader. And that's a proud day.
Yeah. Yeah. I like volunteering and especially at the community level where you can kind of drive past something and kind of know what your contribution to that thing was yeah.
That's a good thing. That's how we met, was through CASDA at the Canadian Autism Leadership Summit, which we're going to be talking about on another podcast. I think that was back in 2018. We're in the middle of COVID, just for a timestamp. We are headed into year two of the pandemic. So time has become a little fluid.
Yeah, at least 3 years ago. Yeah, at least.
So Amy was one of the founding folks.
I helped organize the first one.
Yeah, the Canadian Autism Leadership Summit, and then did her bit and is now working on other initiatives, which is what we're coming to today. So we're going to be talking today about something that's near and dear to most parents of autistic Canadians' hearts, which is housing. And that is something, I got a chill as I said it. I have a friend of mine whose daughter is developmentally disabled, and there is a 10-year waiting list for supportive housing for when she can no longer live at home. And that's just a frightening situation. So tell us a little bit about how Seneve got involved in the housing policy creation for CASDA.
Okay. So just a bit of background on Seneve for anyone that's not familiar with it. We're an operating foundation. Elizabeth mentioned we're in Calgary, Alberta. We really work at improving outcomes for autistic Canadians in the areas of post-secondary, employment, and independent living. And it's the focus on independent living that brought me to the CASDA Kids Brain Health Network Housing Policy Working Group. Sorry. At Cineve, we believe we have a rights-based view of housing, and we believe that every autistic person has the right to housing that's safe, affordable, accessible, and sustainable.
Absolutely.
And an area of focus for us and an area we've been working in and having a bit of success. But it's such a patchwork across the country. And so CASDA and Kids Brain Health sort of looking at it from a more federal policy level was something that interested us. And so I was signed up for that working group. Mm-hmm. There were 5 working groups altogether, a research and governance, affordability and access, employment, housing, and then sort of information or data were the 5 working groups. They worked in sort of through mid-2020 from about March, and then the policy briefs were published in October of 2020.
Yeah, those are available on the CASDA website.
Yep. And there's quite a diverse group of stakeholders that contributed. And I'm here really to talk about sort of what the recommendations were for from the housing policy brief perspective.
And we have talked about housing before, and Courtney Weaver came on, and I'm just having a brain melt. But it was more about, it was a little bit of lived experience as far as Courtney's experience. She is an autistic self-advocate. And then there was a parent. I'm so sorry, but I will find
Perry. It was Perry Johnson.
Thank you. And I don't know why it's COVID brain. And Perry has started a fantastic initiative focused on building independent living opportunities and supporting families who are investigating that. And, you know, from Courtney's lived experience, you know, that needs to drive a lot of the conversation, because we can't make policy without the people who are going to be affected by it. Which is one thing I love about CASDA. They work with the autistic community, not developing stuff without their input. So in the housing brief, this is an incredible document, and I'm just going to share a couple of statistics that have been shared through this. Many autistic adults do not have sufficient income through employment or social assistance to live independently. Data from the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation shows Canadians with disabilities are 60% more likely to be living in core housing need than people without disabilities. Ay, ay, ay. Core housing need refers to housing that fails to meet at least one of the adequacy, affordability, or suitability standards and costs a household more than 30% of its before-tax income. People with disabilities living in homes they own are 1/5 as likely to be in core housing need than those who rent. And while home ownership may be a possibility for a minority, it is financially out of reach for most autistic Canadians, which is frightening. The median income for autistic Canadians is just $9,675. Even with disability programs, these individuals are almost guaranteed to be living at or below the poverty line. We've got more statistics on that. National Housing Strategy established the Canada Housing Benefit, a $4 billion investment starting in 2020, providing approximately $2,500 per year to up to 300,000 recipient households. Sorry, I keep getting notifications and it just wants to keep making chimey noises. From a personal perspective, I've worked with the Autism Job Club here in Burlington for about 4 years, and we had one member in particular who's an autistic self-advocate and artistic entrepreneur. So making, you know, money and what have you, but also having to depend on support. And I can't tell you the number of times they had to do last minute moves because they were living in these hovel apartments infested with bed bugs, and you have to get out. And then where do you go? Like, how do you find affordable housing? We all know how hard it is to find housing on a good day, never mind in a crisis reaction situation. So can you take us through, Amy, a little bit of what ended up happening through the brief and the recommendations it ended up with?
Yeah, I'm just going to add a couple other to just sort of fill out the frame. Mm-hmm. So 60% of autistic adults live with their families. This number, you know, it's thousands and thousands of autistic Canadians that either want to or at some point due to family circumstances need to move out of their family home.
Yep.
And it's, I know that, you know, often the conversation revolves, or you'll often hear the, it's framed around the parent of a high needs child. Mm-hmm. And that is, there's, you know,
that is a reality.
Those out there.
Yep.
But, you know, it's also just a lot of mid 20 somethings need little mid sort of level support. 74% of autistic Canadians in a survey indicated that they need help with at least one everyday activity.
Yep.
But few receive funding for supports. In Alberta, about 14% of the people that Sinead works with receives specific government funding for support. So that leaves us meeting with a lot of people that want to move out, don't really have the income, not sure what support they need.
Yeah.
Because they've never lived by themselves before. Often, you know, parents have sort of one idea, and a 20 something has a very different idea.
You know, that's across all Canadians. That's
right. Is it really necessary that you know how to make your bed to move out? No, it's not. It's not a safety thing to know how to make your bed. So really sort of drilling down on what the support needs are across a spectrum was something that the housing committee had to wrap their heads around. And how do you, you know, make concrete suggestions that fit a spectrum? There's a limited number of options for people with developmental disabilities. And I think that there's a number of factors that sort of contribute to that. Accessibility, you know, there's both accessibility from a process point of view, like how do you apply for the housing subsidy, you know, the $2,500 that's been set aside? What list do you have to be on first before you can get on that list? And there's always a list that you have to be on before you can get to another, you know, you need this benefit before you can get that benefit. So the processes aren't accessible. And then there's the sensory accessibility factors. You know, is it a quiet building? Is it a really loud building? Is it in a safe neighborhood?
That's where we usually find folks can find affordable housing, is in the unsafe neighborhoods, which as a parent, you're like, no, let me help you with that.
And one of the things we have found at Sinead is lots of families do end up having to step in if they have, and every parent refers to their child as their child, like regardless of if they're 30 or, you know, it's, but if a parent is helping a child, even in affordable housing, we find lots of families have to backfill the rent. You know, when you look at something like a less than $10,000 a year annual income, divide that by 12, if 30% of that should go to rent, you're looking at rents around $250 a month.
It doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen. So, you know, depending on where you live, affordable housing, rents are $700, then up to the near market rents.
Come to Burlington, you're looking at $1,200 or more.
Right. So that, nuts. I mean, that's one of the, just how do you even talk about, like, from a housing, you know, the housing committee, that was one of the other things that we ran across, was from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the way they define something like affordable housing is different.
Yes.
And so how do you, if you're a 20 something who's going to start looking, and, you know, you've looked at Rent Faster and you know you can't afford theirs, and someone suggests, you know, well, maybe you could qualify for affordable housing, where do you start looking? How do you get on those lists? And So then you phone somebody and you say, well, I think I need affordable housing. And they get social assistance and they have a job. And so their income's around $35,000 a year. And someone says, well, you don't qualify for affordable housing. And the
you make too much money.
Super literal, hangs up and goes, oh, okay, thanks. But they qualify for near market housing or for some other. So I think that, you know, as this file sort of continues to move forward, one of the things that CASDA and autism organizations and autistic Canadians could do is really start coming up with a common way of talking about these things, common definitions for
common language. Yeah.
Right. For what it means to us for something to be affordable.
No, I think that's, yeah, because it's, if you look at Ontario versus PEI versus BC versus whatever, I mean, the housing market in BC is just as mental as it is here in Ontario right now. And that bust will happen where, you know, right now there's houses in our area who 2 years ago, we sold my mom's townhouse 2 years ago for just over $400,000. And townhouses in the exact same complex 2 years later are going for close to double that because of this current housing boom. That
so more and more renters will get priced out of the market. Yeah.
My kids are looking at us. They're, you know, my son's 23, daughter's just about to be 22. My son's on the spectrum and he's looking at us and he's like, I'm never going to be able to afford to live near you. I'm like, I can't afford to live near me. Never mind you.
And then I think the other, you know, it's interesting that a housing group would be talking about income, right? But
you made a valid point. Having
sufficient income is so foundational to the affordability to having. And so when we have statistics, like only 33% of autistic adults are employed, most of those are underemployed.
Yep.
At minimum wage, you know, depending on where you live in the country, but at a $15 an hour minimum wage, again, you have in a, particularly in higher rental markets, there's an affordability issue.
100%.
So we both need to improve outcomes in income, whether that's working income, social assistance income, some sort of a hybrid of both, but currently, you know, the average annual income for autistic Canadians just doesn't leave a lot of choice.
No, it barely sustains, you know, basics of living, food, clothing, shelter becomes the thing that you let slide a little bit and that you have to find the basement apartments that are not necessarily legal and safe and what have you. Or you leave parents, you know, who are scrambling, like Perry is building an addition onto their, her house, an apartment over the garage for her son, and adds value to the home. So if you look at the bigger picture, yes, but what happens when, you know, families don't live in that house anymore? What happens when the parents no longer are around, which is the reality? So either a sibling, you know, inherits the autistic person, and then what do you do?
And really, like, they're the carriage house or the isn't an option for some. And I think that that's the other, you know, it's always those policy issues that there's no single silver bullet for.
Yep, never will.
I do think that income is as close to a silver bullet as you get, because with sufficient income, whatever the source,
Options open up.
Options open up. And right now we just don't have enough people with enough income.
Yeah.
We're going to see housing on any sort of substantive scale. There are other things that we need to address, but I think that's a big one.
I just wanted to make the point that, you know, Amy's coming to us from Alberta, but this is a Canada-wide issue. And this is one of the things with this CASDA podcast is these are Canada-wide issues. This is not an issue solely out in Alberta. It's not an issue in a single province. This is a cross Canada, all Canadian touching situation. So keep that in mind when we're having this conversation. This is not a single province representing these statistics. This is Canada-wide. So can you tell us a little bit about how the working group came to be? Like, what was the genesis for this and how long it operated? Who was involved?
Okay. So it was a partnership between CASDA and Kids Brain Health Network. Mm-hmm. Was about 7 months, sort of from March to April. Wow. That's 2020. Intensive. We met as a housing working group 8 times, I think. The first thing, you know, housing policy, again, is a really complex area because it hits on all levels of government.
Yes.
So there's a national housing strategy, you know, a federal commitment, federal funding, federal programs. Affordable housing is often legislated, managed, potentially a funding match at the provincial level. Mm-hmm. But a lot of affordable housing is actually owned by the municipality.
Yep.
And there's a big, right? There's a big municipal contribution and component, whether it's in land or funding or as the manager of those affordable housing. And so when you're writing a policy brief, we had to make... CASDA is working on a national autism strategy. We are... Yes. CASDA is working with the federal government. So the policy briefs really, to be disciplined, really focused in that federal arena. Lots and lots of work to do at the provincial and municipal level. For sure, having some level of government really lead the charge. And it makes sense for the federal government, if only for the fact that when you move from Alberta to Ontario, it should be fairly easy to understand the system. It should be fairly easy what you can expect for, you know, in affordable housing should be fairly consistent. What you can expect from a social assistance perspective should be fairly consistent. It's not. Yeah. The portability of moving from one province to another. If you want to move, say, closer to a sibling or and bringing supports with you or transferring, that kind of thing, that is not easily done. And so I think that there really is an important role for the federal government.
Well, it lays a strong foundation where, you know, each province can then iterate on that foundation to suit their population and the socioeconomic situation that their province experiences. I would say that the socioeconomic stability, it seems to me anyway, that each province has consistent patterns with how their socioeconomics plays out. There's not a huge variance within that province, but comparative across the country, there's huge variances between what that province produces, what they're known for, what draws people. I mean, I live on Ontario and apparently we're all fancy pantsy. So, you know, having Toronto and on Ottawa is sandy.
Right. But the feds are the biggest umbrella.
Yeah.
That's the best municipality. Calgary could have a tremendous commitment to affordable housing, but they're not the entity that's going to bring all the necessary players to the table. 100%. I think it really does have to start with the federal government. And
yep.
And so that's really one of the core recommendations is that the federal government take the lead.
Create the foundation. So let's jump into
in the convening. Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
agreed. So let's jump into some of the recommendations. And then this is a fantastic part of the document. This is the policy compendium that's being created. And this is the housing component of that. It's one of the five pillars that's being investigated or being researched and recommendations being created. So recommendation one is convene federal, provincial, territorial working groups to design a disability supplement to the Canada Housing Benefit. So to your point about having to bring all levels of government together to get that support done. Current disability income programs are not sufficient to meet the variable housing costs across cities and provinces. Further, Canadians with disabilities have a smaller set of appropriate rental options available to them due to additional requirements such as the proximity to their support network and other amenities. This often means a higher cost of rent, which if you're not living in the disability space and you're an average renter, you don't stop and think about that. But when you are, like my husband and I are looking at purchasing a townhome, And not that our son can't live on his own independently and ultimately pay rent, but in the end, because of where we live, that's going to be the only way to get them into, my son and my daughter, into the housing market in some capacity. That's crazy. So,
and really not an option for
most folks. No. People. Yeah, I know. Recommendation 2, work with provinces and municipalities on affordable, stable rent control. We recommend calculating current rent using a sliding scale based on income, with rent never exceeding 30%. But to your point earlier, sometimes even that's too great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, especially if the income is sort of low enough, and then you have potentially extra costs layered on related to your disability.
Yeah.
So I do want to, I know rent control is a bit of a hot button. I think what really the point that I would like to make is there's lots of policy levers out there. Mm-hmm. It's not just a single one. It's, mm-hmm. you know, so whether it's a municipality that does do some form of rent control or caps rents or subsidizes, or they're all, there's enough need that there's no one thing.
Yep.
And so if you are somebody who, you know, is out talking to your MLA or your MPP or your member of parliament, and this is an issue that's near and dear to your heart, sometimes those kind of hot button, oh, we need rent control, and it's, we're not advocating for a single exact thing. We are advocating for a menu of things that suit the region,
yeah.
The economic goals of the region. So you can talk about rent control if you want, but just, you know, have that awareness that, you know, sometimes when you're out advocating for a single policy, because it seems fairly simple to you, you know, or seems like a good idea, or is something that would work for you personally in the sort of policy advocacy space, just leave that space for, this is one of those options. This is one idea that might work. But there's actually the need, as I say, the need is so great. There's not a single thing that, so even if you just phrase it as here's one idea, that would be helpful to me personally.
Yeah, well, there's multiple recommendations within this, which is awesome. And there's a reason for that, right? So the foresight is, you need to be flexible, not only in identifying the problems, but in offering some solutions. And if this just gets people thinking differently, then that's great. And I mean, speaking of different thinkers, recommendation 3, implement the recommendations from the Solutions Lab, which is Perry. Designing a registered disability savings plan, home ownership plan. Ooh, neat. Allowing RDSP beneficiaries to withdraw funds to be used towards a down payment on a home.
So you're right. There is an housing through the Autism Lens Solutions Lab. The RDSP, the disability one, like the ability to use that, that was actually driven out of they just changed their name. They used to be Inclusion Canada. I think they're Accessible Canada now.
Looking at the wrong person on that, right?
So CACL, Canadian Association of Community Living, maybe they're Inclusion Canada now. But anyway, it's the intellectual disability community. CASDA has a partnership with them, in Ready, Willing, Enable, which is on the employment side, but, they have been working on that particular, they've been advocating for that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And one of the comments I most vividly remember from this housing, from the CASDA Kids Brain Health Housing Working Group was, you know, there was a gentleman on the housing working group that really was attached to this idea. Like he wants to use RDSPs as a down payment. And when he heard that Inclusion Canada has been working on this for over a decade, that policy recommendation has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
His comment was like, like, what's taking so long? Like, why can't we even get the low hanging fruit? The fairly easy, we can't get that across the line. I think that what's really good, is that, you know, CASDA didn't go out and reinvent something or didn't come up with its own, you know, unique. We went out and we looked at what other disabilities have been saying and advocating for. And mm-hmm. now we've added our voice to it. We've amplified that. Mm-hmm. And that I think is going to be an important strategy for the disability community. Agreed. Not presenting something as though it's brand new.
Yeah.
But in fact, when you can point to something that makes sense and say, like, why have we been talking about this for 10 years?
That's a big number to be having a conversation. I mean,
about really the same thing. Like,
you can grow a human being in 9 months, yeah. but you can't figure out a registered disability plan for home ownership in 10 years.
When you're already able to withdraw from an RRSP, it shouldn't, there's a template there. That's just another.
No, so whoever needs to be listening to this message, please get off your duff. 10 years is, I mean, elephants are made in less time. Come on now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that, you know, in the research, it was at least 10 years ago that you can find references to this as a policy lever. So
that's crazy. That is, it probably took you less time to get your MPA.
It did, thank God. See? Or I wouldn't have it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot can be accomplished in a much shorter amount of time is our point. And this is something that can address so many things, because if you are on a limited income and you have this opportunity, you know, if your parents or whomever has set something like this up, they set it up for a reason. And, you know, the experience through working with the Autism Job Club is the number of parents of autistic Canadians, and the autistic Canadians will never be in a position to hold a full-time job. Just a bunch of things come together that's not going to be their future. And so parents are not only having to plan for their own retirement, but their child's lifespan to have income because of the disconnection of supports across Canada and the inconsistencies in that and how to access it, and parents making too much money, but the kids not making enough money, and all of these weird rules that are in place. Let's make it easier. Because folks, I have to tell you, as the mother of an autistic Canadian, it's not a walk in the park. We need a break. And we can make this easier. We have these smart people that are coming together on these policy groups and bringing together even more smart people from across Canada to show you the way. You just got to pick it up and run with it. So there were some more introductions. We're going to flop over here. Here we go. So when we jump into the summary around this working group's findings, housing is a top priority for Canadians with autism, but the community's needs are unrecognized and underserved in policy. Absolutely. The government has committed in mandate letters to the National Autism Strategy. The community has identified housing as a critical pillar of this strategy. There are clear areas for alignment between the National Autism Strategy and the National Housing Strategy. The NHS identified people with disabilities as a priority population to receive support from NHS investments. You know, our people with disabilities are already disadvantaged and are already in a situation to be taken advantage of and to be marginalized. They don't need to be living in squalor with bed bugs and whatever else, which is what is routinely available. And I'm not saying that as a shock tactic, that's the reality. And that's been my experience in working with folks on the spectrum who've been trying to live independently in housing. Is that to say that there aren't good things out there? Absolutely there are. And thank God for people who are, you know, creating, what would you call it? Like a housing community. I know that's a future plan of a lot of not-for-profit organizations, is to create housing in a community setup, which is affordable, but accessible and everything else. And that's in response to the lack of it existing right now. So CASDA is certainly working alongside different levels of government to help make this happen. There was also some other, oh, here we go. So key context, did you want to address that, Amy, in the document, the key context?
Sorry, I don't know where you are in the document. So I'm gonna...
All over.
I printed a summary cheat sheet. So, yes.
So all good. So because autism is a spectrum disorder, housing needs can vary considerably based on the individual. To Courtney Weaver's point, it's a level of support. So she referenced herself as a low support needs person. But her sister, who is also autistic, is a very high support needs person, ranging from supportive housing to affordable independent living in nonprofit and market housing. For people with autism that need supportive housing, some face extremely long wait lists in their home communities, in some cases more than 20 years. So basically, as soon as your kid's born, you got to pop on the list. With acute challenges in both urban and rural areas, rural must be so much harder because there's so much, such less housing available. Because of restricted eligibility rules, autistic Canadians often find themselves ineligible for the supportive housing that does exist. Super fun time.
So, I'm going to elaborate on that a little bit. So a couple of things sort of related to supports and housing. One of the things that you find is often, and I think too often, the housing and the supports are tied together.
Mm-hmm.
So the service provider owns the home, or an affordable housing provider, and this happens a lot. You have to be attached to a service provider to live in. So in Calgary, for example, we have an affordable housing developer where you have to be attached to a service provider. But there's like 20 service providers in the building. But when you lose that service provider, you lose your housing.
Oh my.
And that's a problem, right? And that's true of if you become, you know, if you live in a autism service agency X in one of their group homes, or and you're no longer happy with their service, you have to move.
Oh.
So I think the way that we think about housing and supports, that there's a potential for a shift there,
mm-hmm.
and decoupling the housing from the supports. And the other reason that makes sense to me is affordable housing developers are experts at building affordable housing,
mm-hmm.
And service providers, you know, are the service provision experts. And to ask a service provider to scale up, to become also an expert in building affordable housing and running affordable housing,
not reasonable.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, the model of, and I think they talked about like mixed market, inclusive housing. That was something that, you know, it comes out in bits and pieces in the, policy recommendations, but really that focus on inclusive housing, on inclusive mm-hmm. neighborhoods, so having affordable housing developments that aren't all people with autism, that aren't all people with disabilities.
Yep.
They are a reflection of the diversity of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You have above market rents, near market rents, and below market rent, and then what would be considered sort of affordable housing for someone with a disability. The percentage of people with disabilities reflects the percentage of people in Canada with disabilities. Yeah. And then the support needs of whoever in the building needs support, it comes to them. It's not always, you know, there are situations where baking it into the facility makes sense, recognize that there's a spectrum of both housing and support, and they don't necessarily need to be tied together. In fact, they shouldn't always be tied together.
And they don't have to coexist in the same space either. And there are existing housing models. Like I drive around Burlington, and it's my weird little thing, but I'm always checking out what a housing development looks like. So for an example, I have one of my big audacious hairy goals is to buy like a 10 story or less apartment, small apartment building, and turn it into an affordable housing model. Likewise, there is a housing complex down the road from me. And the way the townhouse units are built, they're built in a quad formation. So rather than four in a horizontal line, they're actually four in a square. And we had the opportunity to go and visit. We were doing something and I'm looking at this model and I was like, okay, this is really cool, because you then have this existing model. Plans are already available. You know how to build it. It's feasible. It fits. It works with a smaller land space. And you can have a situation where one quad, maybe one of the units, you have support staff living in or operating out of, and then the other three, depending on the needs of the people. But then the next unit is all completely independent and there's no needs office in that quad at all. And then the next one is for anybody who wants to live there. We're not asking people to invent something brand new to solve this issue. There are existing housing models that just need to be repurposed so that they can be used effectively and created economically to allow for this development.
And, you know, and I think the other, at Cineve, we call, when we've worked with affordable housing providers, we call them micro collaborations. Mm-hmm. And we're on our third micro collaboration, and it's really helping an affordable housing developer sort of understand that there's lots of need in the autism community. Mm-hmm. And this is like years long conversations and relationships, but one of the, you know, through the conversations, you know, when we learned that there was an affordable housing provider and they were going to building this new space and they were going to have units, but you needed to be attached to a service provider. Well, that was where Cineve could come in. We're not a service provider in that sense, but we were able to connect with other autistic service providers and say, listen, like, you know, can you offer, what is the sort of skinniest support package that you could offer so that we can attach these people to a service provider, mm-hmm. and get them into this new affordable housing development. And it was a very skinny support package. It was some text and telephone check-ins and a monthly social event. And
which is perfect.
It was $45. So for those clients who were on social assistance, it was a manageable amount. Mm-hmm. Because there were a few that moved into the building, there was a bit of scale there for the service provider. But you know, something like a four unit with a service, you know, one unit for mm-hmm. service support, you know, that's economically quite expensive. Mm-hmm. We have another service provider who, you know, we're looking at like a four bedroom unit it would be sort of two workers and two, and the workers qualify for affordable housing, right? Like, you That's know, crazy. So they're right. Like, you know, I think there's lots of potential out there.
I agree.
But it's really about starting to build those relationships of service providers and affordable housing builders and tenant organizations and landlord organizations. If this is a priority and a pillar, and that is one of the recommendations that's in the brief, mm-hmm. is to build that supply, how do you facilitate those connections between affordable housing developers and service agencies? Mm-hmm. And how does the federal government help take the lead on that? I think there are ways that they can do that. I think there are grants that they could give for, you know, relationship building, mm-hmm. or for a mini conference, or for,
But I think but you hit the nail on the head right there, is that so not so much the mini conference, but that learning and teaching opportunity,
right?
Where, right. So that's why we're having this conversation, is because I would say that a lot of people aren't aware that there is a housing crisis for people on the spectrum, and that there's a lot of assumptions about parental capability to continue supporting that autistic Canadian well beyond what a neurotypical family would normally do, and not understanding the burden that that creates. And from an affordable housing builder's perspective, you know, or if somebody's looking to get into that space, there may be a lot of myths and misconceptions around what that means that could preclude them from participating. And education is always a way to do away with myths, right? It's always a way to create conversation.
I want to turn what you said a little bit on its head, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Well, you talked about the burden on families and the, you know, I really think that what we should be talking about is that there are a large number of Canadians in their 20s and 30s that are living at home with their parents that have a right to an independent life.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, financial burden, not that they are the burden, but
that there's just too many barriers, you know, to their independence, and that we have an obligation to just do better there.
Yep.
The focus on the family sort of it's that inevitable. Oh, well, we're trying to avoid a crisis, mm-hmm. you know, because that's what inevitably happens.
Yep.
And that's not, it puts a lot of tension on a family. We, and I'm sure you've heard them before. There's lots of 20-year-olds that don't want to be living with their parents anymore. And it creates a tremendous amount of tension in that family. And we end up sort of at our resource center with situations where the next tensions are so high that they're really talking about going to a homeless shelter.
Yeah.
And that's, whereas if we said, you know, you have a right to income, you have a right to housing, that starts to have just different conversations, to have, different expectations and it shifts the timing.
Agreed. Like we have no, I know for our son, I can speak to my lived experience. We know that our son's timeline is going to be different. And that's okay. There's that commercial that used to be on about stop serving cheese so your kid will move out. So my husband jokes, you know, if we stop serving cheese, maybe they'll be more happy about leaving, because neither of them seem particularly enthused about. But when you're watching the news and you see housing prices and apartment prices and income not going up accordingly, then as a 20 something, that's a rather daunting thing to navigate. So I can understand, you know, the reluctance. The reality out of this policy brief here, under one of the key contacts, the reality of what Amy's saying with those tensions and people wanting to move out and whatever, the Ontario Ombudsman has pointed to the consequences of these gaps between income and housing. Autistics with high needs ending up in unacceptable situations, including psychiatric hospitals, nursing homes, shelters, and jails. Yeah. And, you know, to Amy's original point, that part of this needs to be addressed through increased employment and access to income. Part of it needs to be addressed through what is affordable housing and what does that look like for each province? And what are the different formulas? Thinking outside the box. We can't continue on the same path we're on because it's not working. It's not solving the problems.
No, and something you said made me think of something else. So at Cineve, we just released a Thinking About Moving Guide where we've kind of really tried to boil down into step-by-step some of the things we've learned working with 20-something autistics who are getting ready to move out. So it can be on found on Cineve's website.
Cinevefoundation.org.
Cinevefoundation.org. But just so that we're sort of normalizing the runway, more than one in three Canadians aged 20 to 34 live with at least one parent. So it's not just.
Are you telling me my kids are going to be here for another 10 years? That was not nice of me.
I to tell you that that
my husband jokes now. He's like, we'll move and we'll give them the house. I'm like, valid. That is valid.
So, but, you know, I think one of the trends you're finding is that for all, like, in very much contributed to by the rising cost of housing and rents, low incomes, COVID, which is going to put lots of people financially behind the eight ball, that runway of staying at home.
Just got a little longer.
It is longer. And it's a third of Canadians over 20.
You just bum me out, man.
I'm sorry. That isn't my intention. But what I do want to say is, you know, it's a tremendous window to figure out what you want and to start thinking about what you want in a really sort of low pressure way. You know, one of the
wiser long-term decision-making versus reactive.
Start saving your rent. You know, if you, regardless of what your income is, if you started that with our kids, who wants to move out, save 30% of your income, start socking it away. That provides a cushion for you. Start thinking about what a budget is. If you want a pet when you move out, start covering the costs of your pet right now. At a minimum, find out what the vet bills are in a year. Yeah. Like, there's so many ways to leverage that longer runway. I think there's lots of things you can do. So anyway,
You just got me thinking because
I get off track.
No, not at all.
Nothing to do with
that. No, it absolutely does this is how I'll tie it in that I think a lot of Canadians assume that autistic Canadians or other Canadians with disabilities, that moving out isn't an option for them. So what's the big deal? There's that assumption when you hear that somebody has a disability, that blanket stereotypical statement, well, they're going to be living at home anyway. So what's the big deal? You know, they have a disability. Why would they want to live on their own? And there's that misunderstanding and misconception that moving out isn't a thing for somebody with autism, when in fact it absolutely is doable and viable. And it is something that is wanted by autistic Canadians.
And I would say more than that. So BC Community Living did a really good survey of housing and people with disabilities. And one of the things they found is that the number of people that wish to live independently, like by themselves, not with a supported roommate, not in a group home, or that number is going up every year.
Yeah.
And with, you know, depending on the spectrum, that should be
an option.
It should be.
And, it should be an expectation.
So anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but.
No, but that's what you got me. So no, that was totally on track. I think it's disabusing the notion that people with autism don't have the ability to live independently. And you know, there is a common misconception. I'll rephrase that. There are common misconceptions around autism that influence this conversation. And it's that we're back to that education conversation piece where it's made really clear that this is a life goal, that this is something we need to work on, because we have a significant amount of the autism community who want to attain that goal and should, and are capable of doing that.
It's a right.
And I worked my tushy off when my son was little to make sure that he was proficient in his activities of daily living. So I don't want that to go to waste. My kid can do his own grocery shopping, his own laundry, you know, vacuum, empty the dishwasher, walk the dog, take out the garbage, take out the recycling. He's like my little slave labor. It's great. I'm kidding. That's going to spark somebody off, but he does everything that he should and could be doing regardless of his diagnosis. So he's, you know, his own thing. You mentioned earlier that there may be one area. His is banking, which I think a lot of young Canadians are not awesome with budgeting and saving and all the rest of it. So that's just a skill set we need to continue to grow with him. But the other thing that we've discovered, again, our lived experience, is that he starts to believe sometimes that this isn't an option for him. And he gets into this mindset from, I'm not sure what exposure, that living independently is never going to be for him. And I'm not sure where that comes from, because we've never said that. It's always been when you move out, and not that we don't want you and not that we don't love you, but that's your right. Your right is to move out if and when you want to. And he wants a home and a family and everything else of his own. So it's nice to know that he has that confidence on some level, that he can do that, which I firmly believe he can. You know, it just learn to vacuum your room a little more. That's my only, you know, situation. But he doesn't, like you said before, you don't need to know how to make your bed to move out.
No, you don't need to know how to cook. You can start with prepared meals and, yep, you know, move
work up from there.
And I think that there's, you know, we're getting off track from the NAS here, but National Autism Strategy and
it all comes together because it's that conversation to make it happen.
There's all these readiness checklists, you know, am I ready? And, you know, there's no single thing that points to readiness. There's no, and even that, I think, you know, you're talking about sort of like education, and I think that if you feel emotionally prepared and you can,
who's ever ready to live on their own the first time,
right? Like, so I think demystifying it a little bit and making it just a part of the trajectory that is like taken for granted. I take for granted the fact that someday my kids will move out.
Well, apparently not at this point. You're saying they're going to be here for like another 10 years.
Well, at some point, you know, between 20 and 34, I'm going to have
fingers crossed.
One of them. But
I think back to your thing though, is that readiness, that checklist, a part of that checklist and a part of that readiness is a policy that begins at the federal level, trickles down to the provincial level, and supports changes in the regional and municipal level, so that this expectation, this right to affordable housing and an independent life, is more than just a conversation around the kitchen table. You know that people have your back in creating policy and supports to make that conversation a reality. And there are enough barriers facing the autism community when it comes to employment and accessibility and other things that this shouldn't be one of them. In this day and age, there are enough resources and opportunities. We have learned enough lessons. We are in the third or fourth generation of autistic Canadians who are entering the workforce and living independently. We need to be listening to these lived experiences, and we need to be learning from them and not continuing to make the same mistakes that we have since the first generation, which was in the 1950s. Like, come on, folks. We have learned how capable people on the autism spectrum are. We have learned that a lot of the myths and misconceptions that first came out in 1948 when autism became a thing are untrue. We have an incredibly talented, creative, responsible, smart individuals who have every right to pursue whatever their future life looks like. And we need to get out of the way and stop talking for 10 years about a disability, registered disability plan. 10 years. I grew two human beings in less time. Come on now. We know more. We can do better on this, and we can make those conversations transition into action. And that ties into our last little bit here, which is opportunities for action under this policy is, over the long term, much more significant policies and investments are needed to expand the housing options available to Canadians with autism. In the short term, CMHC should consider how to leverage its existing investments in the NHS to support the housing, or sorry, to support the goals of a national autism strategy and create greater knowledge and awareness of the housing challenges facing Canadians with autism. The National Housing Strategy includes $241 million over 10 years in investments in housing research and innovation. Innovation is the key in this. We cannot continue to work in this broken system. In our initial scan of existing NHS innovation and research investments, CASDA has identified several opportunities where CMHC could make housing options for Canadians with autism a priority. The NHS Demonstrations Initiative, Call for Autism-Specific Proposals, National Housing Conference, use a conference session to highlight autism housing issues and needs for an affordable housing project pipeline that meets the needs of people with autism. NHS Research and Planning Fund, identify research related to autism and housing needs as a priority for 2020 and 2021. And we're into 2021, so let's get moving, folks. Housing needs data, partner to develop comprehensive data on diverse housing needs for Canadians with disabilities and work to ensure an autism lens is incorporated. Solutions Labs, work to develop a coalition of autism and housing stakeholders to submit an application to the lab. And to ensure ongoing federal policies are responsive to the needs of autistic Canadians, CMHC can also work with the National Housing Council and Federal Housing Advocate to identify opportunities to investigate systemic housing challenges faced by people with autism and ensure policies are formed by lived experience. Stop guessing and start talking to each other. Not to be a hard ass, but I've had the privilege of working with a number of autistic self-advocates who are some of the most eloquent, innovative, intelligent, compassionate, just incredible people who have a voice that needs to be at the table so that these policies are informed by the people that are being affected by it. And I'm here to tell you that they are ready to have this conversation and are more than capable to intelligently inform these decisions so that it is no longer a reactive crisis situation, but a proactive solution for long-term success and independent living for all autistic Canadians. And that's what this policy compendium is recommending. The work is being done. We need to make use of it.
You're here.
Was that a big enough hammer? Half of the hammer. Oh. On a lighter note, you look like you had a thought there.
No, the nothing about us without us.
And absolutely.
Bringing the autistic voices to the table. Just pay them for their time. Make sure they have the technology to engage,
participate, yeah.
Depending on where they are, and those are two things that I think we ask a lot of the disability community from a consultation perspective, and it's almost never compensated.
We need to deliver.
And I think that that's part of how we're actually going to create change and lasting, when it's a project where you engage people with disabilities and you pay them and there's some accountabilities on what the deliverables are. And I think it has more potential to advance the agenda.
It's long-lasting solutions. Yeah, not band-aids.
Yeah, then creating consultation after consultation online. It's a survey. It hasn't done enough, and it hasn't done it fast enough. So what else?
At the end of the day, what we're talking about are human beings who deserve to pursue their goals, who deserve to have the right to housing and income and employment that is fair and equitable. And at the end of the day, this is a human story. And it's not something far off. It's not something in another country. It's not a group that you're not aware of. These are your fellow Canadians who deserve your support and deserve to be heard and deserve to have the same opportunities for success as every other Canadian in this country. And I pause there because it chokes me up a bit that I think we start to look at the diagnosis versus the human being who happens to have the diagnosis. And that's what it comes down to. You know, we are living in one of the best countries in the world. And as a proud Canadian, I'm grateful that my parents came here in 1962 from England. We could have landed anywhere, and they landed in Canada. And I'm grateful for that. And as Canadians, we need to step up and we need to do our job for our fellow Canadians. They don't deserve to be living in bed bugs. They don't deserve to be living in unsafe housing. Nobody does. We need to fix this. So talking about humans, because we're getting a little serious here. One of the things that we do on the CASDA podcast is sort of bring the human element to the team that is working on a variety of projects. And Amy has been a huge advocate within CASDA on many different projects and many different things. So we're gonna talk about the human Amy for a second. And she's like, what are you going to do to me? So people have shared a variety of things that may not be known about them. And we've had, I think it was Vanessa who was like tickling piranha in the Amazon, and Stephanie, who's a double black belt, and Maddie, who's one of the editors of the Canadian Journal for Autism Equity, is a pun master. Actually, so was Courtney Weaver. So Amy, if you were to share one thing about you as a human that nobody would think, what could that be?
So I am a prolific reader. I read 1 to 2 books a week.
Oh my God.
And in this pandemic, I have found great comfort in going back and starting at book one of a series. And so
I'm intrigued.
Well, as an example,
I'm also a prolific reader. So now you got me like,
it's been, so there's one detective series, Eve Dallas, that 56 books.
Oh,
and over the course of, you know, 20 years, 25 years, I've read 56 books about this character.
Yeah.
And so I went back to book one and I read them back to back. And what I didn't ever realize about these books was that they're actually like continuous time in the series. There's no gaps of like 56 books and it's only been 2 years.
I like how that works.
And the richness,
like I'm 25 then or something.
Right. The richness of the character development. And I think I'm on my fourth series where I've gone back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And I'm rereading it, and it's quite cost effective and
valid.
Yeah. And it's brought me a surprising amount of joy. And I think it's a little just that it's comfortable and it's a bit familiar, and I'm reappreciating these old stories in a new way. And, so I don't know that, you know, it's not a double black belt in karate for sure.
Everybody has their own superpower.
It's really boring.
No. I do that all the time. So
it is in fact one of the things in this last year and a half that has brought me quite a bit of joy. And so I thought that for the other prolific readers out there, if there's a favorite series, start at book one again.
Well, it's interesting because I'm involved in 2 book clubs and not with who you'd think. So the first one is with my nephew out in BC, and my sister-in-law started it when COVID hit because David's academic requirements, goes to a private school, involved him reading more books, and they were having a bit of a struggle. So we've now been meeting for a year and a half. We have read, my God, we've read everything from, what was the first book? So I'm going to have a moment now. We read these really interesting teen-based or kid-based mystery books. Like they're all kid-based. The only one actually I was really surprised, we read Jack London's Call of the Wild. which I've never read. Yeah. So I was like super excited about that. We have gone through, we've read A Whale in Paris. We've read Burgess the Frog. We've read, it's been all kinds of different ones. And now we're reading the Narnia Adventures, which I have never read.
Right? I think they're beautiful stories.
They are.
Wardrobe and yeah.
So we've gone, we're now on the fourth book, I want to say. But what's been neat is to see David reading them. But we get on every week and it's my sister-in-law and her parents and her aunt, and one of her cousins, I believe, Sam. And every week we get on and we talk about the book and you have to have questions ready and we discuss different things of it. And of course, the adults are really fascinated by C.S. Lewis's inferences of different Christian theories and whatever. And David's just like, it was a dragon. Like that's, he has some great insight. Actually, surprisingly, he's 10 and he comes out with some really interesting perspectives that were like, huh, look at that.
I think the 10-year-old lens of the world
is
so different than what my 10-year-old lens is, and certainly what my current sort of worldview is. They're kinder, they're more aware, they have
a much stronger worldview, I think, than I. That's where the advantage of the internet, and you know, I have often pondered the negative impact of social media during COVID for a variety of reasons, but I think the ability to show kids other parts of the world at a younger age and build that global awareness has been a bit of a gift of the internet in that capacity. But see, my little reading whatever thing that people might not, just because I'm a massive reader as well. Amy and I have talked about that before. I have read the Harry Potter series in full 8 times.
She's not without her controversy in the autistic community anymore.
Well, this was pre-controversy.
Pre-controversy,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started, I was a diehard Harry Potter from the beginning, so I go back pre-controversy.
I remember waiting in line at Chapters to buy the hard copy book at midnight.
Oh yeah, no, I wasn't that dedicated.
No, I was an early adopter. Yeah. I didn't discover them after. I was like waiting for the book release for
about
the last 5 books.
Yeah.
My
mom would get them and then she'd pass them to me, and then invariably the movies would come out at, my birthday is in June, hers was in November, and so for 10 years Harry Potter was our go-to birthday thing, depending on what time the movie came out. But I remember going to the very first movie after reading the very first book, and my mom and I being the worst movie goers ever, and going, that's not what they said in the book. They didn't do that by getting the book. That just does not match. And there was probably 20 people around us just going, oh my God, would you, you know, luckily my mom had a cane and looked a little, so they're not going to pick on the little disabled lady. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Amy. I appreciate it. And I've learned so much more. We haven't explored, we've taught as a family, it hasn't become a massive issue for us. So I am heartened to know that there are advocates such as yourself and the CASDA team and the Sinead Family Foundation who are involved in making better housing opportunities for all autistic Canadians. So that's, I'm not as scared.
No, but I think there's lots to be excited and hopeful about.
Yeah.
And the federal government has made a huge commitment to affordable housing. And I think it's just, how do we figure out how to really maximize that potential for autistic Canadians?
That's why we're having this conversation. We got to get more voices involved. So thank you for joining us, everybody. Amy's going to stay on, but we're going to say goodbye to the rest of our listeners. We have another 3 months of CASDA podcast coming up on a variety of topics. So I hope you'll join us again. If you have any questions or comments, you can definitely leave them in the comments if you're listening on whatever channel you're listening on. If you have any questions, you can contact CASDA directly at info@casda.ca. You can also visit the CASDA website, CASDA, I believe it's .ca, to learn more about what's happening there with the policy compendiums and the different briefs that are being developed. And please take a moment to visit sanivfoundation.org. You can have a look at that getting ready for a housing checklist that Amy mentioned and all the other great stuff. I've had the privilege of visiting the Ability Hub out in Calgary and meeting the Sanive team, and they are an incredibly dedicated group of individuals who partner and collaborate in such a positive way to make a real difference in the lives of autistic Canadians. So gives me hope. Have a great day, everybody, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining the conversation about the National Autism Strategy. CASDA is a comprehensive network of autistic Canadians and autism-focused organizations. Our members are united by the shared vision that a National Autism Strategy will create improvements in the lives of autistic people for generations to come. Please visit CASDA.ca to learn more and keep the conversation going.